Well, thank you very much for those kind words, Digby, and thank you very much to you all for the invitation today. In my little library at home, I have a box which I call my precious box, and in my precious box there is a certificate, sort of slightly tatty, and it certifies that I was baptized when I was a little more than 8 months old in a congregational church in Whitley Bay. And it's signed by the Reverend Basil H. Sims. I have to confess that about 32 years later, I was baptized, or baptized again, depending on your point of view, and this time in a church in Liverpool, where under the ministry of Stuart Olliott, still alive and living in North Wales, under the ministry of Stuart Olliott, I became a believer. I, after a great struggle, submitted my life to the Lord Jesus Christ. I remember, by the way, we're talking about libraries this morning. Do you remember the library at Belvedere? Do you remember in the library at Belvedere, which was damp, and every book smelt of damp, the books were all categorised into three sections? Well, I remember three. There's obviously a fourth one, especially for Dick. You have to tell us in a moment where it was. So there were ones with a sticker on the back that was green. They were okay to read. There were ones on the back with a sticker on the back that was red. They were definitely not recommended. And there were the ones in the middle. I think they had a purple sticker, if I recall rightly. Good, thank you. But I'm not quite sure the purple sticker. Presumably, they couldn't quite make up their minds, or the elders were not in agreement. What was the fourth category? No?
I thought it was green, yellow, purple, red.
It might have been. I don't know. But anyway, when you took a book out, you had to sign for it. So presumably somebody was monitoring who took out the red sticker books. Anyway, but anyway, it was through Belvedere that I met Digby and Marianne. And through knowing Digby, he introduced me to Roger Williams, who will be referred to later in this talk. And it really, it was that and one other kind of book introduction. I moved later to Worcester, and my pastor in Worcester, Paul Mallard, and when I started talking to him, it was the time in the 90s when there started to be a lot of talk in Baptist circles about pluralism, because Don Carson's book had come out, and there was therefore preaching against pluralism. So I took Paul on one side, and I said, well, surely a pluralistic society is consistent with what we believe as Baptists. And he went off to his library and gave me a copy of Leonard Verduin's book, The Reformers and Their Stepchildren, a fantastic book. So really, those two introductions, Leonard Verduin and Digby's introduction to Roger Williams, those really set me on this trail. And there's been an adventure since. I've given talks on pluralism in various places. I wrote about it in evangelical newspapers. And then particularly when Christian Institute, Christian Concern started coming to the fore, really got my head down and decided I'd better try and write something about this, not just give the odd talk. So the fruit of all that, many years later, is my book, The Jesus Candidate. There are copies on the back if you'd like one today at a special discount price, which I can discuss with you. But so, many thanks to Digby for that introduction and for inviting me today. I hope that your fellowship with Digby survives what I'm now about to say, because you may not like it, and I'm quite prepared for you to discuss, debate, disagree. In fact, I would welcome that. In fact, at the end, if you don't discuss, debate and disagree, I'll do the talk again, because I'll think you won't have understood it. So if I'm controversial, I assume that was the purpose of inviting me. If not, you'll have to discuss it with Digby. Anyway, pluralism, living in a pluralistic society, which was what Digby asked me to talk about. So what do we mean by pluralism? Well, 200 years ago, if we'd been here, and presumably this building is older than that, so we might have been, if we talked about pluralism in Christian circles, we would have meant a Church of England minister having more than one living. That was called pluralism and was generally frowned upon. Well, I don't think we struggle with, I mean, I think all Church of England clergy have numerous ministries to deal with these days. In Christian circles, I'd suggest that pluralism might mean any of the three things on the screen. First of all, in theology, a pluralistic theology means that there are many ways to God, and therefore Islam, Hinduism, Christianity all represent equally valid ways to God. Let me hasten to reassure you that I'm not going to lecture on that version of pluralism. I'm a conservative evangelical. I believe that we come to God through Christ alone, and I'd have no problem in sharing that with anybody, but I don't think it's what you expect to hear at your conference. Secondly, pluralism can be a description of a society where there are many cultures, ethnicities, faiths, etc. The fact of a pluralistic society. And then finally, the third version is it may be an assertion that diverse groups can and should enjoy equality before the law. And a pluralistic society is a society based on this claim. Okay? So if we just reflect for a moment on these two here, let's take the case, say, of South Africa. Up to sometime in the 1990s, it was a pluralistic society in the sense that there were different African nations, there were white people, there were Indians, there were Jews. It was a diverse society. But it was not a society where those groups enjoyed equality. It was based on the domination of one group. Then, with the rise of Nelson Mandela to the presidency, it was based on what it's sometimes called the rainbow principle, that everybody has equality in the vote and should have equality in the workplace and in social affairs and so on. So it went from being a description pluralist society to being an assertion pluralist society. And people use different words for that, but as long as you get the idea. Now you may say, but hang on, there isn't this equality in truth, is there? One group still has massive wealth, the ones with education have more power, etc., etc., etc. So is it really pluralism? It's a good question. And I think what that brings out is that pluralism in this sense is, as it says there, it's an aspiration. It's always a target that a society is striving to reach. It is what we could call a normative idea. The society is based on the norm, the aspiration, the ideal that people should enjoy this equality before the law. Okay, so I am going to focus on this. What I'm saying is we live in a society where we are expected to strive for the principle that all groups have equality before the law. And I'm going to discuss how, as Christians, we might evaluate that claim and live out that claim now. Let me say, I'm not a theologian. I'm not a church minister. I hope I'm a well-taught student of the Bible. But my primary interest is in my work life. I work with communities, I worked on citizen projects, I work particularly with housing and community control of housing. Academically, my main interest is politics. And I basically speak to you as somebody with a strong interest in politics. And I am going to talk to you about Christians living politically and how we evaluate the society we're in politically. If anybody wants to leave at that point, I won't take offence because I know that some people vary in their comfort and willingness to sort of think or discuss political issues. I quite understand that, and quite often I sympathise with it. But I've always been fascinated by politics, which on a kind of side note maybe comes from the fact that my mother was a German Jewish refugee, and I grew up very early on knowing that my grandparents, I was born in 1947. In 1942, my grandparents went the way of many German Jews, which is a deeply saddening thing to know. And I do think I grew up with trying to understand how that had happened. I'm very grateful, of course, for living in a society where I was going to say nobody cares very much that I've, you know, half my blood is Jewish, but that's not really the point. I was able, on the whole, to grow up in a society which didn't make judgments based on that. So, where are we going to find the answers to this question of how to live in a society based on this assertion? Well, we start with the Bible, don't we? And I think I'm not going to give a detailed exposition, but I think if we look at the New Testament, we see that our Lord says that his kingdom is not of this earth. We see, as we did in the reading, we see that the church was called to be submissive to the state. Now, there are plenty of room for debate about what that amounts to. It's good to remember that submission is not necessarily the same as obedience. But generally speaking, the church was called to be submissive to the state, and that was the Roman state. It was a pagan state. It was an anti-Christian state. In the New Testament, soldiers say, well, what should we do? Are they told to lay down their arms and stop serving Rome? No, they are told to do their job honestly and not rob people. Tax collectors, likewise. What are we to do? Are we to spend our career collecting taxes for the hated Roman state? No, just don't steal from people. And we have, of course, great models of people giving the money back that they've stolen. We are told to pay our taxes. The followers of Jesus are told to pay taxes because it's Caesar's image is on the money. In a great verse, our Lord tells his followers that they are not to be like the princes of the Gentiles who exercise authority over them. You are to be different. You are to be servants. As we move into the early church period, as we saw in our second reading, Paul says to the church, you regulate your own business. Don't go running to the state to tell you how to run your business. You're quite capable of doing it yourselves. Decide your own membership. Don't have people, choose not to have people in your fellowship who do not walk the Christian way. But by the way, hang on, I didn't mean you not to mingle with thieves and the sexually immoral and whatever in everyday society. That would be to leave the world behind. Of course we mingle in our day-to-day life with non-Christians, with all sorts of people, but in our churches we manage our own business. And then as we move into the... a few quotes from Tertullian, writing at the end of the 2nd century, and the historians among us might check me on that, but I think that's correct. He says, take the middle one, he is writing here to the Roman rulers. He writes, to the emperor we render such, the lovely phrases, such reverential homage as is lawful for us and good for him. The early church, we frequently find people saying, we respect Caesar. We honour the emperor. We obey the emperor. But we don't regard him as God, okay? And this was the problem, because the emperor, the Roman system, was based on the idea, or reflected the idea at that time, that people had to pray to the emperor, had to offer sacrifice, had to worship the emperor. No. In fact, Tertullian says, it is a fundamental human right, a privilege of nature. Does anybody talk about human rights? It goes back a long way. A privilege of nature that every man should worship according to his own convictions. So he's saying, well, look, we Christians, we respect the state, we obey the state, but we have the right to worship as we choose, so we're not going to worship the emperor. Oh, and by the way, we can only have that right to worship as we choose as long as everybody else does. Everybody has the right to worship as they choose. That gives us the liberty then to worship. And then finally, in a different context, speaking to the community around, Tertullian says this, and he's talking here about the persecution they're facing, not just from the government, from the wider society. He says, we sail with you, we fight with you, we till the ground with you, and in like manner we unite with you in our trading. So what do we see from that? We see a church in the New Testament and in its early history that honours the state, worships as it chooses, says that everybody has that right to worship as they choose, and mingles with the wider society in commerce, apparently in the military, in agriculture, and so on. So here is a church, I'd suggest, that is recognisably comfortable with what we now call a pluralist society. Of course, the Roman Empire had very little idea of a pluralist society. You're all supposed to worship the emperor. But it's a church which is saying, in terms we could now easily recognise, that it's comfortable with the pluralist society. It's also radical because most states in most of history have been based on the idea that the ruler is God or has a personal mandate from God. That's the basis of what in political theory is called legitimacy. Why do people obey the state? In most of history, the state has said, obey us, because of our personal contact with the gods. Either we are gods, or we're, as Georges Berlande, anthropologist, put it, kinsmen of the gods. What's often called the mandate of heaven. If you go to Vietnam, as I did a few months ago, 18 months ago, go to Ho Chi Minh City, in the centre of the city in a park, you'll find a Buddhist shrine to various rulers, and then beside that, a shrine to Ho Chi Minh. Communist, but clearly there, above all, somebody to be venerated and worshipped. So the church, the early church, breaks with this normal historical pattern that the ruler is a god. It says we worship God as God, we obey the ruler as ruler, and the two are not one and the same thing. Very radical. And finally, we see in the New Testament and in early church history, we see no suggestion that Christians should seek to control the state. Not suggested anywhere in the New Testament. So, here's this church. It's free. It mingles with the population. It's radical in breaking the link between God and the state, or breaking the idea that the rulers of the state are God. And therefore, I'd suggest we can find authority there for the idea of pluralism. However, a lot of water's passed under the bridge since then. Quote a great line from a great play, a lot of blood under the bridge as well. So we have this problem of context. We have the problem of 1,200 years or so of Christendom, which has shaped our society and the history of much of the world enormously. Then we have the Reformation. We have Christian states formed after the Reformation under Protestant rule, and we have states around the world, American state, for example, based on the separation of church and state, but still hugely a Christian, nominally Christian nation. So, the question is now, in the light of Scripture and in the light of our history, as conservative evangelicals, how do we evaluate a society founded on this aspiration that all faiths enjoy equal status before the law? How do we witness in a society where the values of pluralism drive much public debate, often to the distress of conservative Christians? And how does this evaluation frame our contribution to public life? Well, I'm going to give an initial kind of framework for that discussion. I think it's a really important discussion for evangelicals to have. I'm going to set out what I think are some principles that can take us forward with that discussion. But let me say, first of all, I'm going to talk about some challenges. I'm going to talk about how to respond to those. I'm going to say a bit more about our history, and I'm going to sort of conclude with what I think is the way forward. So I'm going to say there are two challenges now. I'm going to suggest that I can really only see two possible ways forward. I'm going to suggest that there are resources in the Bible and in church history which can help us, but above all, also help our neighbours, help that wider community understand how we got to where we are and how they are to analyse what are really increasingly challenging issues, as we know, about a pluralistic society. First of all, the two challenges, and I think the two challenges for us I've summed up here as the end of the Christian majority and the rise of the religious right. I'll say a bit more about the religious right. I particularly mean in Britain the Christian Institute and Christian Concern, which I think are linked certainly ideologically to the American religious right. The religious right calls for cultural war against a pluralistic society. It seeks to mobilise us to campaign to restore a Christian state, or if that is not possible, to resist what we now have. It says that Christians are marginalised in a pluralistic society. It's not just the religious right. There are other forces heading in roughly the same direction. There's a movement called Radical Orthodoxy, which is kind of Catholic, which is quite closely linked to the Labour Party, and particularly a movement called Blue Labour. There is Michael Sandel, a very popular philosopher, often on the radio. He says that modern liberalism has failed to meet spiritual yearning. He calls for politics to go back to roots in Aristotle and the search for a common good. So I would say there's a range of forces that are speaking to us about this and are critical of of a pluralist society. But first of all, the end of the Christian majority. 2001 census, 72% of people responding when they were asked their religion said they were Christian. By 2011, that figure had fallen to 59%. 2012, from a different source, not the census, but something called the British Social Attitudes Survey, which is quite an authoritative survey, that said 46% describe themselves as Christian. Now, fairly obviously, that can't have fallen in truth by 13 percentage points in a year. But these are people asking questions, and when people ask questions, they interpret it, they put it in a context. There'll be survey bias, etc. There'll be issues about how it's designed. So I suspect, though, just on the trend, that by 2021, the next census, there will be a minority of self-described Christians. America's on the same path. Some of that kind of slack is taken up by Islam, but Muslims are 6% of the population. Interestingly, when people are asked how many Muslims they think they are, they say 20%, but 6% is the actual proportion of Muslims in the population at the moment. The group that is rising is those who say they are of no religion, and the same thing's happening in the States. Now, how do we evaluate that? Some of us in this room may think, great, because people are telling the truth. Some of us might say, this is the end, not of Christianity, but of nominalism, of people saying they are Christians when what they mean is they're white British, their grandparents went to church, etc., etc. But there is a political impact to this, and it does greatly colour the issue about pluralism. Let me illustrate this. Very good. Yeah, Abraham Kuyper. Kuyper was Prime Minister of the Netherlands in the first decade of the 20th century. He was a great church leader, minister, journalist, huge figure in the history of Christian political thought. Now, he disestablished the Dutch Reformed Church. He introduced what he called the separation of church and state. He was a great admirer of American separation. He brought about something he called pluriformity, so a form of pluralism. He also said that blasphemy must remain illegal because the basis of the legitimacy of the state was the Christian God endorsing the state, right? So, for him, essentially what pluralism meant is that no one Christian denomination was established, that Catholics and the various forms of Protestantism enjoyed equality before the law and were funded to provide education and various other things. Remnants of this still remain. What pluralism has meant up to now mainly has been tolerance. It has meant, from a position of Christian domination, the various Christian denominations tolerate each other, and the Christian state tolerates dissent. Atheism, Judaism, da-da-da. Now, pluralism as tolerance no longer works. There is no longer a dominant position from which others may be tolerated. Or if there is a dominant position, maybe it's agnosticism or atheism. So we need something more robust if we think that pluralism is a New Testament model. Let me quote to you something that John Stevens said recently. John Stevens is director of the FIEC, Fellowship of Independent Evangelical Churches. I'll read the full quote and I'll come to this one. He says this, he was speaking at the conference of Affinity just a few weeks ago. Affinity is like a kind of FIEC-like. It's a fellowship of evangelicals, maybe some of you have a connection there. He said, Christian campaigning organisations have fought a long war of attrition against the dismantling of a pseudo-Christian state, especially with regard to the liberalisation of sexual morality, but have failed to recognise that this battle was lost long before governments introduced the relevant legislative changes. Christianity was rendered implausible as the basis for civic life and the legal framework because it no longer exercised any hold on the hearts and minds of the people. Very often, this was a failure of the church itself, whether because of its failings, abuses, pride, presumption, bigotry, intolerance, or tolerance of false teaching, which thought it could advocate for morality without faith. This inevitably raises the question of whether Christians' rights and liberties are being restricted, or whether Christians need to reassess what the Bible requires of them. Christians in the UK need to return to a genuinely biblical political philosophy, shorn of the mistaken assumptions of Christendom, which see the state as a vehicle for the enforcement of the morality of the church. So I think that sums up the challenge. I'm not sure John, in his subsequent 27 pages, actually comes up with solutions to the challenge, but I think that does sum up the challenge. And I can see two alternative ways forward. Neither of them possibly particularly easy to sum up, but I'm just saying, logically, coherently, there are two ways forward. Number one, if we want to defend a pluralistic society, then the state is neutral in matters of faith. It is for the individual and the community to decide what is good. That's option one. Or option two, neutrality is impossible. And neutrality is impossible is the basic philosophy of the religious right. In the book, I go on at much greater length about the religious... I believe Marion's reading it, aren't you? Much greater length about the religious right and justify, I think, reasonable length, give the evidence what I'm saying here. But two kind of key quotes. First one is from somebody called Rusas J. Rushdoony, who was the founder of the movement called Christian Reconstructionism, American Presbyterian, writing in the 60s, 70s. And he said, "No society exists without a religious foundation or without a law system which codifies the morality of its religion." And he said, this whole idea about a secular state, that's impossible. That is just humanism as a new religion. And he said, what we're seeing is, with the decline of the Judeo-Christian state, we're just seeing this transition, and we'll get this humanistic state which will persecute Christians. And that is a kind of key argument which underpins the thinking of religious right organizations. And then this is a quote from the Christian Institute on its website about its political philosophy. Everyone know the Christian Institute, who I'm talking about here, based in Newcastle, sees itself as an evangelical pressure group for a different kind of approach to politics. It says, "To fail to privilege one religion would be for the state positively to endorse either a secular humanistic philosophy, which results in atheism, or a multi-faith philosophy, which is opposed by faithful people in all religions." So it's the Rushdoony thinking, that the state must have a religion. If it chooses not to have a religion, what it's actually doing is putting forward atheism, secular humanism, as its religion. So its basic position is Christianity must remain privileged in the legal system. Church of England must remain established. We must defend the establishment, but that's just part of the picture. Key thing is we must protect this nominally Christian state. And of course, who are the Christians these days? Increasingly, the old established churches are in decline. It's the evangelicals, it's the independent churches. So for this to work, they must gain the active support of evangelicals, including independent evangelicals. So it's difficult to read this into the New Testament. I don't find this in the New Testament at all. I'm just kind of summarising a longer argument here. But the way they justify this is, first of all, looking back to the Old Testament, which was really where Rushdoony stood, that Mosaic law is normative, and therefore all the laws and punishments of the Torah need to be legislated, and that's what a Christian state should seek to achieve. And I am kind of summarising, and there's more in the book about unpacking what he believed, but I think that's a fair summary. Then they say, well, then the New Testament period is essentially a period of transition. So all the religious right people look back on Christendom, and they look back for all its faults, that Christendom, the establishment of the church in the Roman Empire, that was the direction that the early Bible church was heading in. And some of them even say, well, when Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this earth," he meant not yet. He was looking forward to this time of church establishment. So how did this come about? Well, People blame Constantine. Now, let me be very clear. It wasn't Constantine. Constantine was earlier. Constantine legalized the Christian church. He restored property that had been stolen from it. He did meddle in church affairs and set himself up to determine theological disputes. But Constantine never did what happened in 380 AD. It was 380 AD under Theodosius, if I've got that pronunciation right. We got the Edict of Thessalonica, and that declared Christianity to be the religion of the Roman Empire. The Christianity was defined as what was taught by the bishops in Rome and Alexandria. That was recognized as Catholic Christianity. All others were heretics who didn't have churches, they had conventicles, and they were subject to punishment. Over the next 60 years, the Catholic Church received legal and financial privilege, tax privilege, immunity from secular law. The pagan temples were suppressed, and the death penalty for defiance of that was introduced. So in that period, the church became established and became the key intermediary between government of the state and daily life in the cities, the provinces, rural areas. And I'm very, very quickly summarising something, but this is a great quote from a historian about the church under Christendom. The medieval church was a state. It had all the apparatus of the state, laws and law courts, taxes and tax collectors, a great administrative machine, power of life and death over the citizens of Christendom and their enemies within and without. It was the state at its highest power. So, at that point then, Christianity was the state, and then as we know, start of the 16th century, Christians rediscover their Bible, and the church starts to climb out of Christendom, therefore start to cease to be a state and start its journey to being what the New Testament describes as the state, as the church, a voluntary association of believers. But it was a struggle. The early reformers continued with the territorial church, Zwingli, Luther, Calvin. And that inevitably overlaps with the state, because the church must be recognized by the state. The state says that everybody must be a member of the church, and the church must struggle to control the religion authorized by the state. But really, they all knew, and Luther famously struggled with this, they all knew that truly the church had to be the confessional church or the gathered church. It should be an association of believers. The church, generally speaking, made that transition, but that does leave the question of what is the state for? And in the 16th and 17th century, Christians struggled with the question of what is the state for? And the key questions here were, is it the role of the state to uphold true religion? And Oliver Cromwell believed it was, and struggled desperately with how he was to do that. And the other question which relates to that, if we have a gathered church, a confessional church, can members of the church take part in the business of the state? Or is it just, as Muslims would say, haram, forbidden for Christians to do that? And there were different points of view, and early Congregationalism wrestled with this issue. And the point of it is that there are really two alternatives that come from that. Either Christians must take power in the state and hold power so that true religion can be enforced, or Christians live at arm's length from the state, forming communities that kind of are tolerated at best by the state, such as the Mennonites in the Low Countries, running their own affairs but agreed with in exchange for some money, agreed that they'll be left alone. Now, one man found a way out of this. No? Roger Williams. I was assuming that everybody here would know all about Roger Williams, because there was a great paper by Digby a few years ago at this conference. But no. No. 21 years ago, apparently. He sent me a copy of it. Right. So Roger Williams, Anglican clergyman, had contact with the early Baptists in 1620s, 1630s, England. A respected scholar, goes to Massachusetts 10 years after the Pilgrim Fathers. Here he finds himself in the theocratic political system established by John Cotton, a congregationalist theocracy, where it was believed that the state had to uphold true religion, the state recognized the true churches. You only got citizenship if you were a member of one of those churches. Roger Williams falls out badly with John Cotton and the theocrats of New England. A, he doesn't agree with this thing about recognising a true church and a true religion from the state's point of view. Also, by the way, he thought they didn't really own New England because they'd stolen it from the Indians, so they should be negotiating with the Indians to buy the land. So John Cotton and co. didn't like that. Roger Williams gets thrown out. He lives with the Indians for a period. He learns their language, becomes an expert on Indian languages. He buys land. He founds the state of Rhode Island. He needs to get royal charter for that state. He arrives in England in the first years of the Civil War, where the relationship of church and state is the issue of the hour. And he writes this, The Bloody Tenets of Persecution Discussed, fantastic book, available only on a Google digitized edition, I think. There's a few in libraries, I'm sure. So this great quote that opens it, which is well known, God requireth not a uniformity of religion to be enacted or enforced in any state, which enforced uniformity sooner or later is the greater cause of civil war, ravishing of conscience, persecution of Jesus Christ and his servants, and of the hypocrisy and destruction of millions. Millions of souls. Now, Williams is sometimes said to have developed the idea of the separation of church and state. I'm not sure that he ever actually used that term, but that is the concept which is attributed to him, and I need to be stopping very soon. But two things, I'll just hasten a little bit. Two really key things, I think, that Roger Williams enabled his breakthrough. First of all, John Cotton said, quote at the top, a subject without godliness will not be Bonnesfer, a good man. So the government must be run by Christians, because they're the only people who are good, aren't they? And what William says on this is brilliant. He says, well, there's a good garment, there's a good house, and there's also a good physician, a good seaman, a good pilot for such and such a shore or harbour. That is morally and civilly good in their several civil respects and employment. A subject, a magistrate, may be a good subject, a good magistrate in respect of civil or moral goodness, which thousands want. And where it is, it's commendable and beautiful, though godliness, spiritual goodness, which is infinitely more beautiful, be wanting. Okay? So he says that you can be a good politician, a good ruler, because you're good at the job, because you're honest, because you do the job faithfully. And that's true whether you're a Christian or not. And he observed the government of the Indians, and he knew how they governed themselves. He thought you could have perfectly good government without Christians in charge. Then, of course, it raised the question, also put by John Cotton, well, if we don't have Christian government, how is government justified? And William's answer is the sovereign, original, and foundation of civil power lies in the people. A people may erect and establish what form of government seems to them most fit for their condition. So what Williams did develop was two key ideas of what we now call liberalism. And I would suggest that Williams invented liberalism 50 years before John Locke. First of all, what's called the priority of the right over the good, The job of the state is not to decide what's good. The job of the state is to do its job competently and preserve the liberty for others to decide what is good. So William's main concern was the freedom of the church, what he calls soul liberty. As the church, we have the right to decide what we in the Bible find to be good. And that means everybody else has the right to find their own way to what is good. It's not for the state to say what's good. And secondly, that the basis to what gives the state legitimacy is not rule by God or endorsement by a religion. It's the endorsement of the people. So William's model drove the growth of Christianity in America in the 19th century, mainly through Methodist and Baptist churches. Read Mark Knoll further on that. He provided Kuyper's model, separation of church and state. But in the recent century, bringing us up to date, there is really now a crisis in this idea of the pluralistic society. That's particularly come from America, where some judgments in the Supreme Court in the middle of the 20th century saw separation of church and state as meaning no state funding could go to religiously based education, mainly cases concerning Catholics. So most of the Protestants were quite cool with it, but Everson and Lemon cases did that. So that goes much further than the European model, where we have state-funded religious education. We have Father Newhouse, a book called The Naked Public Square. We have anxiety over are we removing the spiritual content from our politics? Michael Sandel admires Obama because he, to some extent, reached out to Christians, was himself personally a professing Christian. There's a lot of talk now about the common good and should we pursue the common good. I think there's a problem for Christians in that because we believe that no one is good but God, don't we? If the state starts determining, if the political process starts saying what is good and what is not, that is a threat to the liberty of the church. So, as I said before, I think there are the two alternative ways forward. And I think if we are to follow in the footsteps of Roger Williams, if we are to say pluralism is a biblical provision, we need to examine where we are now and move forward from there, then I think we say the state is properly neutral in matters of faith. Liberal secular pluralism in politics, I suggest we should say, is a Christian idea, founded on the need to protect the purity of the church. It is for individuals and groups to decide what is good. It's not for the state or the political process to decide what is good. Now, there's proper anxieties about this. And none of this is easy. Does it mean that Christians cannot be in politics? Well, of course not. I mean, Roger Williams was a great statesman. It means that Christians enter politics to provide good government, to protect liberty for the sake of truth, a rather kind of vulnerable property as we know these days. Roger Williams says, what's the difference between a Christian politician and a non-Christian politician? The difference is a Christian politician does his job to the glory of God. So I think we need politicians who will say, I'm a Christian, I do my job for the glory of God. I'm not here to, obviously I want to evangelize, but that's not what I'm in politics for. I'm not here to make laws which make other people into Christians. I'm here to do a good job of government for the sake of the community. Now, there's only one. I can only see one other option, which is neutrality is impossible, and this is the position of the religious right. Quote from Reverend Holloway, a trustee of the Christian Institute and writer. When the church fails to influence society and its rules and regulations so that they conform as much as possible to God's will, the result is not happy neutrality, rather the result is a nasty spiritual and psychological slum. So, he says, the job of Christians is to go out there and make rules to make the rest of society more godly. Now, I don't recognise that picture as being a New Testament picture. I don't believe that people are saved by rule-keeping. I don't believe that God calls us to keep rules. I believe we keep God's rules out of love for God, but a loveless rule-keeping is not what God calls for. And this really means that people who are not Christians, they may say they are, but people who are not Christians will benefit from this rule-making, which is going to make them somehow more a Christian society. Now, once you start on that road, somebody's going to come along and promote Christian rule-making for people who are not Christians. What will happen? What will happen is that non-Christian politicians will come along and say to these non-Christians, I'll make Christian rules for you. And that's how you end up, among other things, with Donald Trump. Saying, I'll give power to Christians. I'll keep the Muslims out. Now, I'm not here to evaluate Donald Trump. You may have your own views on Donald Trump. I'm just illustrating the dangers of this road that the religious right wants to take us on. They say that tolerance is possible only from a position of dominant Christianity. They claim to represent a Christian majority which doesn't exist, or if it does exist, it's purely nominal. They claim to want to revive a Christian state. They see secular law as persecuting Christians. They demand that Christians be privileged in the legal system. I think that is morality without faith, as John Stevens puts it. So the case I think I've put to you is that we are pluralists. We defend the proper neutrality of the state. And as a final thought, John Calvin said, it were a very idle occupation for private men to discuss what would be the best form of polity in the place where they live. Seeing these deliberations cannot have any influence in determining the public matter, any public matter. Well, now we live in a democracy, and we all have the right to deliberate on the best form of polity. If we are to be submissive to the state, we need to be making a contribution to a discussion which is going to be very important in this country over the next few years, about values, about Britishness, etc., etc. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about there. And I think we have important news for people from the Bible, from Christian history. We understand this history. We are the product of this history. Let us explain to our neighbours what this history is, what they have, how they got to where they are with a liberal, pluralist, secular political system. Let us give glory to God by proclaiming its truths. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul.